From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, why doctors should stop worrying about getting sued and get back to worrying about what's best for the patient. We'll talk with George Annis, director of the Law, Medicine, and Ethics Program at Boston University. His new book, Standard of Care, examines the ethical questions raised by doctor-assisted suicide, organ transplants, abortion, and life support systems. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new John Coltrane box set. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Clinton administration is trying to raise money to help with the startup of a Palestinian administration in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank town of Jericho. The Associated Press quoted administration sources as saying that the United States is asking allies to help come up with $200 million to set up a self-ruling government. The money is seen as an additional incentive to get the Palestine Liberation Organization to accept the 5-year plan for an interim self-government. Secretary of State Warren Christopher told NPR today that most of the money for the startup will come from other nations, but that the United States will try to help facilitate the contributions. Jordan's King Hussein is criticizing Palestinians for not consulting him on the details of the agreement with Israel for limited Palestinian autonomy. Lori Neff reports from Cairo.
King Hussein is calling for an Arab summit because he says inter-Arab coordination is lacking in regard to the Middle East peace process. In an interview broadcast on Jordanian media today, he says Arabs are passing through what he calls a dangerous phase. The king doesn't directly reject the Israeli-Palestinian agreement, but he says Jordan would reject any pact to which his kingdom was not a party to. Jordanian officials say they are angry and hurt at the lack of PLO consultations over the plan. One official says PLO leader Yasser Arafat didn't even discuss the agreement when he visited Amman last week. Jordan, meanwhile, has also expressed fears that the plan could backfire, triggering a flood of refugees that could destabilize the kingdom. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff reporting.
The former manager of the Atlanta branch of an Italian bank has pleaded guilty to arranging more than $5 billion in illegal loans to Iraq. From Atlanta, Ed Hula reports.
Today's plea from Christopher Dragul comes 6 days before his trial was scheduled to begin in federal court. Dragul is accused of arranging a complex series of loans to Iraq during the late 1980s that were backed in part by a U.S. agriculture export program. Iraq supposedly used the money to help build up its military. Dragul has maintained he was following orders from bank headquarters in Rome, and the former judge for the case says he thinks a U.S. government cover-up is at work. But prosecutors say Dragul acted alone and out of greed in setting up the loan scheme. Last year, Dragul entered a guilty plea, then withdrew it. His lawyer says Dragul now wants to avoid a lengthy trial and hopes to be sentenced to the 17 months in prison he served awaiting trial. For National Public Radio, I'm Ed Hula in Atlanta.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 19 points to close at 3,626. The NASDAQ Composite Index was up 2.52 to close at 748.67, its fourth record high in a row. Declines edged advances in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The Clinton administration expressed support today for the territorial demands of the Bosnian Muslims in negotiations to divide up the former Yugoslav Republic. The Muslim-led Bosnian government rejected a plan that would give it 31% of the land. Instead, the Muslims want nearly 35%, as well as a corridor that would give them access to the Adriatic Sea from Sarajevo. Secretary of State Warren Christopher said that Serbia and Croatia should yield to the Muslim demands. The state of emergency has been lifted on some parts of Hatteras Island, North Carolina, but it will still be weeks before life there returns to normal. Adam Hochberg of member station WUNC reports.
Utility companies are making progress restoring electricity, water, and telephone service to this remote island on the North Carolina Outer Banks. But many buildings are extensively damaged, and it will be weeks before some merchants can reopen their stores. Emily brought 115-mile-per-hour winds to the tip of Cape Hatteras and floodwaters as high as 7 feet. Although no dollar figure has been put on the damage yet, many owners of souvenir stores and tackle shops say their inventory was a total loss. Few expect to be open Labor Day weekend, traditionally one of the biggest tourist weekends of the year. In the town of Buxton, which was hardest hit, flood water and sand still cover the main highway, and residents are still trying to remove broken trees from their yards and seaweed from their homes. For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Hochberg at Cape Hatteras, North Carolina.
Flood victims in the Midwest are complaining about the Clinton administration's latest formula for disaster assistance. The formula effectively calls for the federal government to pay 75% of the cost of repairs for damage to public facilities. States and local governments would have to put up the rest. If states can show that damages amount to at least $64 per person, the federal government will increase its share to 90%, but none of the Midwestern states can meet that criterion. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many doctors live in fear of lawsuits. They find themselves asking, "Can I get sued if I do this?" rather than asking, "Is this the right thing to do?" My guest is a specialist in medical ethics who says that we can't let the fear of liability shape our approach to health care, and we can't let the courts set the agenda for medical ethics. George Annis directs the Law, Medicine, and Ethics program at Boston University's Schools of Medicine and Public Health. In his new book, Standard of Care, The Law of American Bioethics, he examines the ethical disputes surrounding abortion, doctor-assisted suicide, life support systems, organ transplants, the AIDS epidemic, and genetic research. Annis criticizes doctors for worrying too much about lawsuits, but realistically, do doctors have any choice?
Well, absolutely, because the law is, although doctors don't seem to believe it, is that the standard of medical practice is set by the profession itself. So the question, the legal question is the doctor negligent, is answered by, well, what would another doctor do in the same or similar circumstances? What is good medical care? I mean, to put it concisely, good medical care is good law. And doctors should be reassured that that is the case, and should get back to the practice of medicine and let lawyers get back to the practice of law.
Do you think that the more doctors are ruled by fear of liability, the worse the fear of liability gets?
I think it does feed on itself. Actually, if not worse, it certainly gets reinforced by our current financing system where doctors get paid. For the more tests they do, the more they get paid. So in one sense, it's an excuse. I'm doing this because if I don't do it, I might get sued. Where the truth of the matter might be, I'm doing this because I make more money doing this. And unfortunately, the more doctors do this is, whatever extra diagnostic test it is, then the more that doing that test actually becomes standard of care, becomes the standard by which other doctors actually perform and practice medicine. So there's a perverse incentive there. It's almost a circular thing that the more doctors do, the more they have to do. And this may cost them, prompt them to do even more then. So.
You write that good ethics begin where the law ends. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a tendency in the United States to use the term law and ethics, almost like it's one word, law and ethics, and to think that law and ethics are really the same thing, when, of course, they're quite different. The law simply, tells you what you must do, what you have to do to stay outside of jail, if you will, or outside of the courtroom, not to be an outlaw. It sets a very minimal standard of conduct, but one that you must follow. Ethics is something much higher than that. It's much more aspirational. It's what you should do to be a good doctor, not what you must be, not to be an outlaw doctor. So good ethics does begin where the law ends. The law ends with duties, things that doctors must do, not to run afoul of the law, whereas ethics is a much higher calling, things that doctors should do, again, to be good doctors.
You think that judges are often not the best qualified people to make medical decisions or decisions about medical ethics. Why not?
Well, I think you just put it well. I mean, judges obviously can't make medical decisions. There's nothing in the judge's training or in legal training that qualifies or in any way begins to let you think about how to make medical decisions. Judges should make legal decisions. They have to tell us what the law is, what the parameters are within which doctors and patients can operate. But one of the great problems in the last 20 years in legal medicine and bioethics has been judges actually coming to hospitals to go to the bedside and making decisions which are, in large respect, treatment decisions, not legal decisions at all. And judges basically have no business in hospitals, have no business making treatment decisions. They can't act any different than you or I or the average layperson coming in off the street could act. They're in an alien environment. They have to make a snap decision without the benefit of reflection or legal arguments. And they're simply not institutionally or temperamentally or by training qualified to do that.
What's an example of a treatment decision that's been made by a court?
Well, I think the most notorious example is the case of Angela Carter in Washington, D.C., a young woman who was dying of cancer and was 26 weeks pregnant. And the question was whether or not her fetus should be delivered by cesarean section. And rather than talk it over with her or her husband and her mother who were there and try to get the decision at the bedside, the hospital called a judge, had an informal hearing in the hospital, and decided that, well, she was dying anyway. So the judge thought, well, let's try to save one life. Let's do the cesarean section. Without thinking about her rights, any of the legalities in the case, or any of the past precedents which would have given her the right to make that decision.
And I think Angela Carter, the woman with cancer, had made it clear that her priority was to be as comfortable as possible as she died.
Well, I think that's true, but even if you didn't think that was true, it turned out that near the end of the hearing, Angela Carter, who had been unconscious during the hearing, regained consciousness and was able to converse with her doctors. Yet the judge, who was only two or three doors down from Angela Carter's room, refused to go to see her and refused to talk to her. When any lawyer or judge would tell you that the law is the decision has to be made by the competent person, that's the person who gets to make the decision. And the fact that the judge didn't even go to talk to her was just remarkable. And again, shows just how out of his element the judge was in the hospital. He really couldn't even keep straight basic legal principles.
Now, do you think the hospital going directly to the court is an example of medicine being ruled by concerns of legal liability?
Yes, I think that the only reason a hospital or a doctor should ever go to court over a patient care issue is to decide whether or not the patient is competent. I mean, that is a legal decision, whether the patient is competent or not, to be able to understand the nature and consequences of their decision, to know, you know, what the treatment options are and what the likely consequences of each treatment is. But that's the only time, and that really seldom comes up.
So in the Angela Carter decision, the decision was to perform a cesarean to try to save the baby. What happened was the baby died shortly after it was born, and Angela Carter, the mother, died, I think, just a couple of hours after the birth.
A couple of days after.
A couple of days. Okay,
yeah,
thank you.
Right.
Now, how would you have reasoned through that if the hospital had come to you? And so, George Annis, help us in this dilemma. Do we just make the pregnant woman with cancer as comfortable as possible as she dies, or do we perform a cesarean, making her terribly uncomfortable as she approached death, but with the hopes of saving her baby?
I would say to them that the law has always been very clear that competent adults have the right to make decisions themselves, that you don't lose your right as a competent adult to make treatment decisions because you're either pregnant or dying, and the fact that you're both pregnant and dying doesn't make you non-human or doesn't take away your human rights. So you have to talk to Angela Carter about that. This is her decision. In fact, if the fetus, there's a lot of discussion about the viability of the fetus. The fetus turned out to be not viable. So I think what we're really talking about here was a forced abortion, which is terminating a pregnancy with a non-viable fetus. So there's no question that Angela Carter should have been able to make that decision. Not the doctor, not her husband, not the judge, but Angela Carter herself. And that I would tell doctors, as I do tell doctors, talk to your patients. Talk to your patients. Make the decision with your patient. It's her decision. You help. You give her your best advice. You can even try to persuade her as to what you think is right. But ultimately, that's her decision.
And if the patient isn't conscious?
Patient isn't conscious, you should try to plan for that. Now, we don't always do that, but you should try to talk to your patient beforehand if you have good reason to suspect he or she is not going to be conscious during the entire hospitalization, and that can very often be predicted. In this case, you first ask them what they would want done under certain scenarios. And then number two, I think, because people can't always predict what is going to happen during a hospitalization, ask them to designate someone else to make decisions for them in the event they're unable to participate in decision-making themselves. And I would ask her who she would want to give authority to make decisions for her in the event she wasn't able to decide herself, her husband, her mother, both of whom were there, who she would name. And that's getting to be a little more common in hospitals, but I think it's very important, because just because she's not competent doesn't mean the doctor gets to make the decision, and certainly doesn't mean you should go to court. What it means is someone else gets to make the decision, and the best we can do, even though it's imperfect, is to have have the patient designate who that person should be, because we would expect them to name someone who has similar values to them, or who will at least try to make decisions consistent with the way they believe the patient would decide the issue.
Now, I wonder how useful you think hospital ethics committees are in deciding tough choices.
Well, I think that committees in general are not very useful in making decisions. Anyone who's been on committees knows that. And hospital ethics committees are probably the worst of all at making decisions. Although it should be made clear to everyone listening that hospital ethics committees in the vast majority of hospitals in the United States, and most hospitals actually have these committees, are not set up to make decisions. They would be the last group to say they should make any treatment decisions. They're mostly set up to educate the staff, to raise consciousness, to make sure people know about the ethical issues, and sometimes to consult with patients, but more often with the hospital staff, with physicians and nurses, about difficult ethical dilemmas. But committees should never make decisions. Again, the decisions should be made in the doctor-patient relationship, or as close to that relationship as possible.
If you're just joining us, my guest is George Annis. He's the director of the Law, Medicine, and Ethics Program at the Boston University Schools of Medicine, Public Health, and Law. And he's the author of the new book, Standard of Care, The Law of American Bioethics. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. George Annis is my guest. We're discussing his new book, Standard of Care, The Law of American Bioethics. You say that the law has really been responsible recently for setting the medical agenda, and therefore medical questions have been recast in a more legalistic than medical context. For example, the morality of medical treatment near death has been recast as the right to die. What's wrong with seeing it as the right to die?
The medical ethics agenda, not the medical agenda, first of all. But the right to die, I think, is a slogan. I mean, it almost implies, as with other rights, that there's an option, that I don't have to exercise my right. You certainly don't have to exercise your right to abortion, for example, or your right to information. But we're all going to die. And to think that there's a right to die, again, implies that there's an option, that we don't have to die. And that this is something that that is a liberty interest in terms of refusing it. It's much more, from a legal point of view now, and I think from a realistic point of view, it's much more important to think about a right to refuse treatment, that there's no duty to undergo or to partake in all the wonderful things, and medicine does have many wonderful things, that medicine has to offer that might prolong your life. Those are all optional. That respirators, dialysis, organ transplants, chemotherapy are all optional with the patient. You have a right to refuse treatment, but death is not an option with the patient. All of us are going to die, whether we want to or not. The other problem with the right to die slogan is it implies that doctors might have some duty to actually kill you if you want to die. And that's where we've gotten involved in this whole discussion of physician-assisted suicide and even physician euthanasia or active physician killing. And I think it comes out of that feeling that patients have a right to control not just their treatment but their death, and that if they can't, that they have the right to have the doctor help them control at least the time and method of their death. Which has no, by the way, I think has no either ethical or legal basis.
Well, let me start with the Nancy Krushin case. And she was in a car accident and survived the accident, but survived in a vegetative state. She lived in that state for about 7 years. The parents wanted to remove her from life support, and the court said no.
That's correct. Nancy Kruzan was in a state almost identical to Karen Ann Quinlan, probably the most famous bioethics case in the history of the world, in that she was a young woman in a permanent coma who was never going to wake up, never going to experience life, never going to be conscious. Nancy Kruzan, unlike Karen Quinlan, the only difference was Karen needed a mechanical ventilator to help her breathe. Nancy Kruzan was able to breathe on her own and needed only tube feeding to keep her alive. And the question was whether her parents could remove that tube feeding. They went to court, and the lower court said, yes, we think you can. We think that it doesn't make much sense to continue this kind of vegetative existence when you don't think your daughter would want that. The Missouri Supreme Court disagreed. They said that the state of Missouri had an absolute interest in life. Nancy was alive. The doctors could keep her alive. And unless she herself had said, if I'm ever in a permanent coma, I want to die, even if the only thing that's keeping me alive is tube feeding, and if I'm going to starve if I don't have my tube feeding. They, in other words, the Missouri Supreme Court said she had to give her own personal informed consent to refuse treatment. The U.S. Supreme Court, in the only so-called right to die case that's gotten in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, agreed. They said that the state had the authority to have that rule if they wanted to, that the only person who could refuse life-sustaining treatment was the individual themselves. In that opinion, Justice O'Connor, who had a swing vote but voted with the majority, said that basically that she thought if Nancy had just said, if I can't make decisions, I want my mother to make these decisions, that that would have been a constitutionally protected delegation of authority to her mother. And her mother could have said, as her mother did say, please take Nancy off the tube feeding. Ultimately, the result of the Kruzan case has not been that the states in the United States have passed laws saying everybody has to accept every treatment no matter what if they haven't signed a living will or said they refuse it in advance. Instead, most states have now passed statutes saying that your next of kin gets to make these decisions if you haven't formally delegated that authority in a health care proxy or a durable power of attorney.
Does that seem like a decent outcome to you?
Absolutely, because as long as everybody knows about that, as long as you and I and everybody knows that if we don't write, as we know, if we don't write a real will for our property, the state will decide who gets our property. Half of it will go to our spouse, half to our children, as a typical example. As long as everybody knows, if you don't designate someone to make decisions for you when you can't make them yourselves, that your spouse is going to be able to legally decide whether to treat you or terminate treatment. I think that's perfectly fair. And I think the fact of the matter is in the United States, we're only about 10% of us sign organ donor cards, that not much more than 10 or 20% of us are ever going to sign living wills or health care proxies. So that we really do have to have a rule that says who gets the authority to make decisions for us if we ourselves don't take the responsibility, which I think we should take, to designate someone in advance.
Let's get to the ethics of doctor-assisted suicide. You have strong words about Jack Kevorkian. You've described him as a serial killer of women.
Well, I did describe him as that, and his first eight subjects or victims, whatever you want to call them, were women. After that, he did his procedures on a number of men, so that he doesn't just do women anymore. But I think he is a serial killer in the sense that he does kill people with certain characteristics and kill many of them in an identical pattern. I think he's very chilling. I do think he's very chilling. Yes. The remarkable thing is that the American public basically seem to support Kevorkian. And what they seem to be saying is this, is that medicine does such a terrible job at helping people, supporting people, caring for people at the end of life that we'd rather than go to the hospital and put ourselves in the hands of doctors who are not going to treat us well and may abandon us and leave us in pain, we'd rather doctors just killed us and got it over with. I mean, I just think that's a tremendous indictment of modern medicine. And I'll give Kevorkian credit for that. He has certainly raised the ante and raised that issue to a mainstream issue.
If somebody who has a terminal illness,
yes,
and is in pain,
yes,
makes a decision that they just as soon end it rather than continue to deteriorate and be in more pain as time goes on. And they go to a doctor and they say, look, I'd like to kill myself. Why not help me do it in a way that would be quick and painless? What's wrong, in your point of view, with the doctor helping them do it in a quick, painless way?
Well, we have to unpackage that and see what helping means. Certainly doctors have an obligation to help people die well, and good doctors do this all the time, that they stay with the patient, they keep them as free from pain as possible, and they continue to comfort the patient and never abandon the patient. You may not characterize that as help in dying, but I certainly would, and I think that's what a good doctor does. Doctors do have an obligation to alleviate bodily pain. They do not have an obligation or any credentials or any expertise at alleviating the suffering that goes on when we discover that we're not immortal, that we are going to die, and that we don't like it. I mean, it's just not the doctor's job or expertise to really help us with that issue. That's a real issue of humanity, human life, and probably more religion and philosophy than ethics even, and not an issue the doctor can or should deal with. And again, doctors have never been licensed to kill. It was just James Bond, I think, our fictional character, had a license to kill. Doctors don't have that license. They can help us, they can comfort us, but they should not kill us.
You've even made a connection between Jack Kevorkian and his lethal injections, lethal dosage of pharmaceuticals to help a person die. You've compared that to doctors who help administer lethal injections as execution for people who have been sentenced to death. What's the connection?
Well, the connection is really quite direct. The movement in the United States toward lethal injection instead of hanging people or gassing them has been that lethal injection is more humane, that it's better to have a doctor execute a prisoner than a hangman, for example, because that, again, that's more humane. And that seems to make death seem much more acceptable. I would think it even seems to make capital punishment seem more acceptable because it's a medical thing, and medicine has historically been seen and is a beneficent profession whose primary obligation is to the best interests of its patients. The method that Kevorkian used initially, his suicide machine, was actually designed by him to be used on death row. And not only is the connection metaphorical, the connection is real in his case, because his whole career has been to try to get wardens to adopt his so-called suicide machine for use in death row, so that the organs of people who died on death row could be used for other people. So it's precisely the method that's identical, and the use of a physician to make the deed seem legal and even seem medical.
George Ennis is the author of the new book, Standard of Care, The Law of American Bioethics. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Ennis will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Jerry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, more with bioethicist George Annis about why he thinks the abortion rights question should be restated and about why we should re-examine the goals of healthcare as we revamp the healthcare system. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews John Coltrane recordings from the Atlantic Vaults, reissued on a new box set. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Now at the halfway mark, the latest round of Mideast peace talks in Washington has still not produced a much-heralded agreement between Israel and the PLO. But Barry Schwed reports progress is being made on the Syrian front.
It's a matter of marking time on the Palestinian front. Elsewhere, Israel and the PLO are grappling with the terms for mutual recognition and the Palestinians with who will sign the declaration with Israel establishing Palestinian self-rule. It's not entirely an academic discussion. If a senior PLO official signs, it means more status for Yasser Arafat's group, but means downplaying the Palestinian delegation from the territories. In the meantime, the Israeli-Syrian talks are making headway. The atmosphere is cordial, and both sides seem pleased with their work on a declaration, at least part of which should be finished next week. And all this is leading to serious bargaining on an Israeli withdrawal on the Syrian front in exchange for peace with Israel's powerful Arab neighbor. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwed at the State Department.
In Egypt, a group of suspected Muslim extremists used their court appearance today as a way to show anger against Arafat's agreement with Israel. They shouted that Arafat is a traitor for selling Jerusalem to Israel. The defendants are charged with belonging to the group Vanguards of Conquest, that's fighting to overthrow the Egyptian government. About 800 suspected members have been arrested this year. The formal unveiling of President Clinton's health care reform plan isn't due for another 3 weeks, but today the president revealed several key details of the plan. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton confirmed a report in the Washington Post today that his health care plan will not rely on price controls to bring the cost of health care down. But he insisted that, contrary to the Post's assertion that he had ruled out price controls, he said he had never embraced the concept. Many economists consider price controls to be unworkable, and several administration officials had argued that price controls would be too much government control. Clinton still must decide how to come up with the funds to subsidize coverage for low-income workers and small businesses. The White House revealed today that most Americans will be guaranteed medical coverage by 1997 under the plan. The new system will be up and running in a number of states as early as 1995, and there will be a firm deadline of December 1997 for the remaining states. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Clinton says the option of airstrikes in Bosnia is very much alive. The president said today NATO warplanes might attack if there's any shelling of the capital Sarajevo or disruption of relief deliveries. The warning appears aimed at Bosnian Serbs and Croats who are fighting the Muslim-led government. The three sides failed to reach agreement at the Geneva peace talks yesterday, but President Clinton said the U.S. will try to get them back to the table. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost 19 points to close at 3626.1. This is NPR. Nicaraguan President Violeta Chamorro today took steps to reduce the influence of the Sandinistas in her government. She removed the Office of Military Intelligence from the army and put it under presidential control. Chamorro also announced she hopes to find a replacement for Sandinista military chief Humberto Ortega next year. Chamorro is under pressure from the U.S. Congress and her own conservative supporters to reduce the power of the Sandinistas. Defense Secretary Les Aspin says his proposal for a leaner military is different from former President Bush's plans. Some analysts say Aspin's bottom-up review of the Pentagon, announced yesterday, is not a major departure from the previous administration. NPR's Martha Raddatz has details.
In a speech today at Georgetown University, the secretary focused on changes the Clinton administration's plan makes from the Base Force program established in 1990. That program, stressed Aspin, was designed before the collapse of the Soviet Union. The bottom-up review forces, he said, will be smaller than the base force structure and less expensive. The secretary did say, however, that there would be some additions compared to the base force, citing the numbers of Marines as an example. Under the base force program, the Marines' troop strength was 159,000. The bottom-up review calls for 174,000. The secretary also stressed again the dangers of regional conflicts that the U.S. may face in the future, today naming Russia, which Aspen warned could become a major regional threat. I'm Martha Raddatz. In Washington.
In Somalia, American troops today searched for illegal weapons at the facility of a Seattle-based charity. But the head of the relief group says the soldiers were very respectful and knocked on the door first. The caution is in contrast with a mistaken U.S. raid on a United Nations group last week. In that incident, the Americans thought they were uncovering a military control center. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. What does a leading medical ethicist have to say about revamping our healthcare system? George Annis is back with us. He's the director of the Law, Medicine, and Ethics Program at Boston University and author of the new book, Standard of Care. Before we get to reforming the healthcare system, I want to get back to something we discussed earlier. Annis says he's afraid the law is setting the agenda for medical ethics. He says one example is abortion, where the morality of abortion has been recast as the right to abortion. I wanted to know what he thinks is wrong with posing the issue as abortion rights.
Well, I don't actually think there's anything wrong with calling it the right to have an abortion. The point is that when you look at it from the strictly legal rights scenario, it's really a very impoverished discussion. I think the discussion is, by the way, absolutely right on one level. I think that the state, the government, whether it's the federal government or the state government, has no business telling women that they must continue a pregnancy or that they must end a pregnancy. I really do believe that that is just a fundamental privacy, liberty interest that women have to make that decision themselves. And at the current time, because it's really not feasible to safely abort yourself, you have to involve a physician as well, and that's not an issue. But that just begins the discussion. That an ethical discussion would go much beyond that legal discussion and try to figure out how women become pregnant in cases where they don't want to be pregnant, how we deal with teenage pregnancy, with rape and violence and gender discrimination, how we deal with birth control in the society, what alternate types of abortions can and should be available, what alternate types of child care and child rearing options should be available, etc. It just tends to limit the discussion in such a way as to make it almost sterile in a sense.
As a medical ethicist, how do you weigh the rights of the fetus and of the pregnant woman?
Well, using rights language again in that context, just as you put the question, I think misstates the question.
Mm-hmm.
Fetuses, whatever their status, don't have rights. I mean, you can't have rights, you can't have constitutional rights unless you're a constitutional person, for example. And fetuses aren't considered constitutional persons by anyone on the U.S. Supreme Court, even the four justices who believe Roe versus Wade should be reversed. Entities that have never had any consciousness or have any idea they're even alive, let alone what their future might be, can't even be said to have interests, let alone to have rights. So when we talk about the rights of the fetus versus the rights of a mother, I think we set up like a false type of struggle. And I would always tend, as many Americans would, to always go on the side of the weakest person in that struggle. And so I think we would tend to think, well, gee, you know, we must protect the fetus. And if the fetus had rights and interests, I think we would. My own view is actually consistent with the Supreme Court's view in Roe and more recently in Casey, that the fetus can't even be said to have interest, at least until viability, when its brain has developed to some extent that it could possibly survive independent of the mother, when it could live a life, when it might have some pain receptors, etc. And that it's only at that point that we can even begin that discussion. And even then, I think we have to concede that the mother's interests or the pregnant woman's interests are so extremely central here that she should still have primary decision-making even after viability.
My guest is medical ethicist George Annis. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is George Annis, author of the new book Standard of Care. The Clinton administration is revamping health insurance in America. You support universal health insurance?
I support universal access to health care. I mean, I think that looking at it as universal insurance is too narrow.
Mm-hmm.
Because just the fact that people have insurance, especially when we're dealing with people in the inner city, with people who are widely dispersed geographical in the rural areas, does not in any way guarantee them access to health care. And we have to look at it broader. I mean, insurance is one way to help give people access to health care. But it's that alone would be an insufficient debate. We need to broaden the debate to make sure people actually get access to the type of health care that they need.
Could you give us a sense of what your priorities would be if you were reordering the American health care system?
If I ran the zoo, well, the first thing I think that we'd have to look at what our goals are. I mean, we almost have a mantra now that we're going to deal with cost, quality, and access. And currently, cost is the heavy issue. Everybody wants to contain costs in health care because we're spending $1 trillion a year, almost 15% of our gross national product, and much more than any other country. Obviously, you have to deal with all those things, I think, together, cost, quality, and access. But you can't deal with any of them until you know what your goals are. You know, what's the purpose of medical care? And that's an issue America simply hasn't come to grips with at all, because it has seemed as if our primary goal in health care is simply to increase the length of life that everybody can have in the United States. And indeed, we have done that, although more from public health measures and general nutritional standards than from medical measures. But we have increased the length of life. The problem that we've run into is most of our latest increase in length of life has been length of life of a severely disabled life at the end of life. And so more and more I think we have to say that really that can't be our goal. Our goal can't be to try to have people live forever, that just is not only unrealistic, but that's a silly goal, that our goal really has to be more oriented toward quality of life. What medical interventions make our lives better, make the lives of most people better? How can we prevent disabilities rather than treat disabilities, right? How can we prevent cancer rather than how to treat cancer? How can we make people's lives better? And I think we need much more emphasis on quality of life. Some of that will be obviously emphasis on prevention instead of treating catastrophic illness, and much more emphasis on how to deal with suffering, with human suffering, rather than how to deal simply with disease entities, illness and accidents.
Let's see if we can make that concrete. If you're accepting that the quality of life is more important than lengthening life, how would that change the priorities of medical care?
Well, we know, for example, that in just Medicare, the program that pays for most health hospital care for individuals over 65, that 30% of that money is spent in the last 2 to 3 months of life, right at the end of life. We spend most of our money, or much of our money, our high-tech medicine money, right at the end of life. And we do that not because we think that's where it's the most effective, but because at the end of life, we really can't accept death. We can't accept death at all. We're probably the most death-denying culture in the world. And so medicine has come to see death as the enemy, that death is almost always the enemy. And so we spend money mostly trying to prevent death rather than trying to promote health. All right, so we would try to concentrate more of our money and more of our resources at the beginning of life. I mean, the president certainly knows this, that it's just outrageous that we don't vaccinate, for example, all of our children at the beginning of life. That's not only cost-effective, it makes sense for their entire lives. It helps them lead healthier lives for decades rather than for months or weeks, as we would do at the end of life. So we try to reorient that priority and try to get Americans, very difficult, to try to accept the notion that they're not going to live forever, and that spending immense amounts of money at the end of life on marginally beneficial care is not an appropriate thing for the health system to do.
What is your critique of the direction the Clinton administration plan seems to be heading in?
Well, it's hard to critique it until they've told us exactly what they're going to do. But insofar as managed competition is going to be the centerpiece of the Clinton administration's proposal, and that competition is going to be between insurance plans for your business to try to compete, competition against various insurance plans for the business of employers who will insure their employees. That just strikes me as being a waste of time. I mean, the insurance companies are probably the primary group that got us where we are now by simply indemnifying physicians for everything that the physicians did. And to essentially hand over the healthcare system to insurance companies and ask them to compete against each other for medical business and to essentially buy medical practices and hospitals and organized groups strikes me as essentially a prescription for disaster. I mean, it can't possibly work. All it can do is increase the cost and volume of healthcare, it seems to me. And worse than that, it will take away where I believe the locus of decision making has to be in any ethical healthcare system, that is between the doctor and the patient. It will take much more authority away from doctors and patients and put it in the hands of these insurance companies to decide what the benefit package is going to be, what doctors can and can't offer patients, what patients can and can't expect from their physicians and their hospitals. And it does not strike me as an interesting or useful way to go. And you can think about it yourself. You can think about, or any of your listeners can think about, their own interactions with their insurance companies, whether it's health insurance, life insurance, auto insurance, or any, and see if they think they can get satisfaction from their insurance companies better than they can get from their doctors today.
I was reading an article recently in the New York Times about how a lot of doctors in private practice are selling their practices to public companies because the doctors are afraid they won't be able to support a practice as the new Clinton administration system goes into effect. Do you see the healthcare heading in a more and more corporate direction? And if so, what do you think the gains and losses will be?
Yes, healthcare definitely is headed in a more corporate direction. It has been for probably the past two decades. Arnold Rellman, the former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, has been warning about this for about 20 years, that medicine is becoming much more of a business than a profession, and that business ethics, in fact, are trumping medical ethics in more and more cases. And I think that this will become exacerbated as doctors worry about their own financial future, whether it's viable to be able to have a solo practice, which probably isn't viable anymore, or a small clinic practice, which are what are mostly being sold now to larger companies. And we are going to see medicine, we have seen medicine become more and more of a business rather than a profession. We have seen business ethics transcend medical ethics. And certainly any realm of managed competition is built on the notion that medicine is a business, that it should be managed like any other business, and that there should be market competition like any other business. And that's the great flaw, I think, in the Clinton plan, is that medicine isn't a business, shouldn't be a business. It shouldn't try to maximize the amount of diagnostic or surgical care it gives to individual patients. It should try to work for the best interests of individual patients and their health care, not to maximize profits of themselves or the companies that they work for.
Have you been confronted in your personal life with some of the ethical decisions that you've dealt with professionally?
Yeah, I'm actually very happy to say that I have not had that opportunity yet, and I hope I will be able to be as forceful when it comes time to make those myself as I have been in judging other people and the way they've made them.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
George Ennis directs the Law, Medicine, and Ethics program at Boston University. His new book is called Standard of Care. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we have several pieces on the Middle East peace agreement, including one on Jewish settlers in Jericho. That's an area which will be handed over to Palestinians fairly soon. Mara Liasson is considering the White House attempt to sell the North American Free Trade Agreement. We have a piece on mopping up after Hurricane Emily and the damage it caused. A little town in the Middle West, which was flooded so badly that it will need to be completely rebuilt. Townspeople are trying to decide whether it makes sense to do that. And an expert from the Federal Emergency Management Agency on where you can live in the United States and be safe from disaster.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Before John Coltrane joined Miles Davis in 1955, he hadn't recorded much, a few numbers with Earl Bostick, Dizzy Gillespie, and Johnny Hodges, and a few informal tapes. Today, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will play some Coltrane solos you probably haven't heard before, which have been released in a new box set. But first, let's hear some mature Coltrane, also from the box set. This is Cousin Mary, recorded in 1959.
That's John Coltrane in 1959, during the 2 years or so when he recorded for Atlantic Records. For a major label, Atlantic has been oddly indifferent to the classic jazz in its vaults. The reissue specialists at Rhino Records have done a good job handling Atlantic's R&B catalog. Now they've taken control of Atlantic's jazz backlist, too. Rhino's first major release is a 2-CD Coltrane anthology called The Last Giant. It's a nice surprise, for one thing because Atlantic stuff makes up less than half the set. The real meat is 5 rare items by the young Coltrane. Here he is at age 24. John Coltrane with Dizzy Gillespie in 1951. Because Coltrane hardly recorded before he turned 29, musicians and critics have been free to say whatever they like about his early development without fear of contradiction. One thing you hear about Coltrane is that he was a late bloomer, that he didn't conceive a distinctive style until he was about 30. He had his formative influences like everyone else, notably Charlie Parker and Dexter Gordon, but these early recordings show how much Coltrane always sounded like Coltrane. As saxophonist Steve Lacy says, your style's either there from the beginning or it's not there. Here's Coltrane in 1946 playing alto sax with his Navy band on Hot House. He sounds green, but even at 19, he's balancing double-time phrases against pregnant silences, something he'd do ever after. By the time Coltrane was 24 and had switched to tenor sax, he developed another key part of his style, the heraldic sound, the voice that gave his playing such presence. This is with Dizzy Gillespie's sextet and singer Fred Strong. Coltrane's last major stop before joining Miles Davis was the band of saxophonist Johnny Hodges, a master of the striking entrance. Hodges always sounded suave and slinky, whereas tenor player was excitable. But Coltrane picked up on Hodges' knack for grabbing your ear with the opening notes of a solo. Now he really sounds like John Coltrane. He was 27. Last Giant isn't a perfect Coltrane crash course. The title's inaccurate. The tracks from his Atlantic years mostly come from just two LPs, and the box skimps on the last and wildest part of his career. It's not the comprehensive early Coltrane CD we should have, but for documenting his emergence, it's the best thing out there. He blooms before your ears.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic living in Brooklyn. He reviewed The Last Giant, the John Coltrane anthology, on Rhino Records. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Bob Alls, Chris Fraley, and Ron Barron. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, great singers. We hear from Abby Lincoln and Tony Bennett. It's part of our weekly series of interviews from the archives. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.